For the past century, no other condition has caused as many deaths as heart disease. By the 1950s, the incidence of heart disease had reached epidemic proportions. This epidemic peaked in the 1960s, and although much progress has been made, heart disease remains the number one cause of death in the United States. Hello, I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. For the next hour, we will be discussing the topic of heart disease. Our guests tonight include Dr. Anil Chhabra, a senior cardiologist with Cardiology Associates in Shreveport, Jill Lucero, youth market director for the Louisiana section of the American Heart Association, and Jared Mitchell with the Willis-Knighton Cardiac Rehabilitation Program. As always, we invite you to join the discussion. We will take your questions at 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Chhabra, thank you for joining us tonight on Health Matters. Tell us, Dr. Chhabra, thank you for joining us tonight on Health Matters. Tell us, why is heart disease still the number one cause of death in the United States?
Thank you, Dr. Brewer, for having me, and I'm delighted to be here. Well, heart disease, unfortunately, is the number one leading cause of death among men and women in the country. The reason being our dietary habits, genetics, and the epidemic of obesity and diabetes have played a major role in that. Also, the culture of smoking, which fortunately is getting better among adults but not among teenagers, is an additive factor.
Thank you, Dr. Chhabra. Jill, thank you for joining us tonight on Health Matters.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, what is the role of the American Heart Association in our struggle against heart disease?
American Heart Association has been around for many, many years, and it's devoted to saving people from heart disease and stroke. It's number one, America's number one killer and number four killer. They team up with millions of volunteers to raise funds for innovative research, we fight for stronger public health policies and education, and we provide life-saving tools and information to prevent these diseases to the public. That's our main focus, is to work with the public and to educate them on heart disease and stroke.
So public education, raising funds for public education, prevention, fighting heart disease through education and prevention.
And providing grants, research grants. We are one of the top organizations that provide research grants for heart disease.
Excellent. Jared Mitchell, thanks once again for joining us on Health Matters.
Thanks.
You know, in the first few days or weeks after a heart attack, what do you see as the most important next step a patient can make to avoid having another heart attack?
Well, one of the main changes that could take place after a heart issue will be the doctor will start you on some new medications. And those medications are very crucial, and it's important to take the correct dosage that's been prescribed. And also, don't go through lapses where you're not taking those medications. They're very important. I think that's the first step. And then, you know, after a couple of weeks, then it would be time to take a self-assessment and say, okay, you know, there's some things you can't control that contribute to heart disease, such as age and family history, but there's some things you can control. You need to take a self-assessment and say, okay, what are some things going on in my life that maybe I can change that can reduce the risk of this happening again?
So taking the issue out of the doctor's and the hospital's hands, so to speak, and taking the issue into your own hands, perhaps, after that first heart attack.
Definitely so. I mean, you got to look, am I getting... Do I have a good exercise routine? Am I smoking? I need to stop that. Is my weight correct? Am I eating right? Those are some of the top questions you have to ask yourself.
Thank you very much. As always, we invite you to join our discussion. We'll take your questions, 1-800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our guests tonight include Dr. Anil Chhabra, with Cardiology Associates in Shreveport, Jill Lucero with the American Heart Association, and Jared Mitchell with the Willis-Knighton Cardiac Rehabilitation Program. Again, the number here is 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Chhabra, What are some of the more important heart facts in general that you see as they apply to our society today in the United States?
That is such a pertinent question that you asked. There are 600,000 deaths related to heart disease every year in America. One in all four deaths are related to the heart. And coronary artery disease, which is a component of heart disease where you have blockage in the artery, is the commonest of the health diseases and kills about 385,000 people every year. There are roughly 715,000 heart attacks in America every year, and of these, 525,000 are the first-timers, and approximately 200,000 are having a second heart attack. And it's an enormous cost as a nation that we bear, in tune of $108.9 billion in healthcare costs, drugs, and lost productivity. So it's a monster of an issue to deal with heart disease.
Yeah, it is a monster. I think, you know, we mentioned in the opening segment, you know, the epidemic really started after World War II. You know, we really started to see heart disease as a major contributor to overall deaths in the 1950s. The epidemic seems to have peaked in the 1960s, and now it's down to about half. You know, heart disease still is number one in terms of being an important killer. How have we brought it down by half, and how can we bring it down even further? What's happened then, and what are we doing now to continue to see declines? Or have we seen a decline?
I think the awareness has come long ways. The American Heart Association has been a tremendous value in that. Overall, smoking incidence is down considerably, unfortunately not among teenagers and young children, as we mentioned, but among adults. And also, with the advent of lipid-lowering drugs, primarily statins, there has been significant reduction in incidence of acute heart attacks. And also, over the years, people are now more aware of diabetes control, weight reduction, and exercise programs, so they all go in hand in hand.
So it sounds like stopping smoking has contributed, and we also have important drugs that lower lipids. And that
Absolutely.
Has contributed as well. What about treatments for heart attacks? I know we used to use clot-busting drugs when patients came into the emergency room for having symptoms of a heart attack. Now we use things like cardiac stents and balloons to blow up the vessels. And, of course, in the 1970s, we had the advent of the open heart surgery and the cardiac bypass. Where do you see the technological aspects of treating a heart?
Angioplasty had its advent in early 80s. And then we went on to, because of the problem with angioplasty was they were abrupt closures, which mean you open the artery up, either you redevelop the blockage or the artery closed down abruptly shortly thereafter. Then came stents, which are wire mesh or stainless steel laser cut devices that are mounted on a balloon, and they become a scaffold on the inside of the artery. Going back to the issue of using clot-busting medicines, we still use that, but more so in rural areas where there's not immediate availability of a heart cath lab. Standard of care for heart attack patient today is to get to emergency room, if possible, in a hospital where there's a cath lab and a team available where we can take them to the cath lab immediately and open the artery up.
So you would take the patient to the cath lab immediately. So we're talking about a heart attack, which is presumably due to a clot in one of the arteries going to the heart. So what are the signs and symptoms of a heart attack for those who are listening at home?
A heart attack, going back to the causality of that, is because of plaque rupture, and then the cholesterol-like cheesy material comes out, and then a blood clot forms on top of that. The symptoms can be ongoing chest discomfort, which could be in front of the chest or it could be between your shoulder blades. It could be jaw pain. It could be throat tightness. It could be shortness of breath, with or without nausea, with or without sweating. And women in particular tend to have atypical symptoms more than men. And in majority of people, they have had some degree of symptoms off and on before, which may have been ignored as indigestion, heartburn. But there are any number of people who have heart attack as the very first symptom.
And so when you say women have atypical symptoms, what are some of the symptoms that a woman might have that would be a signal for a heart attack?
It could be fatigue. It could be shortness of breath. It could be upper abdominal pain, shoulder pain. And some of them are common symptoms, but they can present in somewhat unusual fashion symptoms. So you just have to be aware of that and be thinking of that.
You know, a lot of patients will talk about they break out into a sweat when they're having symptoms of a heart attack. How often does that actually occur? Is that something that the patients should look out for as well?
About 50 to 60% of the patients will have sweating, along with even nausea and vomiting.
And fluttering in the chest, is that common as well?
That may or may not be, but it's just an intense feeling of fullness in the chest that a lot of people, or they say, like a ton of bricks on my chest is a very common.
A ton of bricks, or maybe an elephant, for
or
example.
Or an elephant on my chest, exactly.
You know, Jill, we're talking about what's obviously is an acute myocardial infarction, or acute MI, which is a heart attack. The American Heart Association has done a lot to train people who are basically maybe first responders in terms of witnessing a heart attack. Who should learn CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation?
Everybody. Anybody that's upright and breathing, really. You're never too young to teach CPR to anybody. A child can learn it. A three-year-old can learn it. There was just recently in the news a five-year-old that did CPR on her dad. He called 911. They walked him through, and now it's only hands-on. You know, it's only hands-only CPR. So the compressions are the most important thing. And she did CPR until the responders got there and saved his life. So anybody can learn CPR. We just got done doing a CPR class at Woodlawn High School, and we're doing another one tomorrow morning at Linwood Middle School. And it's available to come to the schools, staff, teachers, anybody that's around, really, that needs to learn CPR. It's so important.
Upright and breathing.
Upright and breathing.
And so you're mentioning hands-only CPR mm-hmm. now, so that references maybe back in previous times where we used artificial respiration or mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. We call it alternating with chest compression. So you're saying hands-only now. Tell us a little bit more about what hands-only means.
Hands-only CPR is just compressions now, because the whole idea is once you do your compression to the chest, to the heart, it's going to get that blood circulating. It's going to get it circulating to the brain. It's going to make the lungs work. It's going to get that blood circulating, and that's what we want, because if we don't get the blood circulating to the brain, it's going to cause brain damage, and that is definitely not what we want. So hands-only CPR is just the compressions. And one of the easiest ways to know the beat to the compressions is the Bee Gees song, Staying Alive. That's what the American Heart Association recommends. You can go to heart.org, learn CPR. There's a great website called Be the Beat. It teaches hands-only CPR and tells about that. But that song, Staying Alive, is the beat that you want to do your CPR to.
So roughly about 100 compressions per minute, something along those
yes.
lines. And so if someone wants to sign up for a CPR class tomorrow, where would they go?
We partner with Christus Schumpert a lot. And the other thing that you can do is go to the www.heart.org website, and there's a listing of CPR availabilities and places that you can call to get that done.
So www.heart.org.
That's right.
Okay, thank you very much. You know, Dr. Schauber, we talked about, again, acute myocardial infarction. Obviously, you want to call 911. You know, if the person has actually lost consciousness, CPR is definitely indicated. In someone who has not lost consciousness, dialing 911 is important. But we've also talked about having aspirin available at that time. Is that still recommended?
It is totally recommended, and it should be done. And the important thing is patients should not procrastinate over when they're having chest discomfort. It may be your stomach, it may be your pancreas, but it may be your heart. Because once you're having a heart attack, it's so very important to be able to get to the hospital very quickly. It's not the heart attack in the first hour or so that kills people. It's the arrhythmia that goes with the heart attack, which can only be treated with defibrillation or with a shocking device that's available either externally or in public places if this happens, or if you're fortunate enough to be in the hospital where they can shock your heart out of a deadly rhythm called ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation. And we look at what we call a door-to-balloon time. Once the patient hits the door in the ER, our aim is to get the patient out of the ER into the cath lab, have the artery open under 60 minutes. And we have succeeded in that, and that preserves your heart muscle.
So in terms of, preserving heart muscle, we're talking about calling 911, using an aspirin, chewing the aspirin, doing CPR if the patient loses consciousness, and getting to a hospital that has a cardiologist on call or on staff so the patient can get to the cath lab, which refers to putting a balloon in the artery or a stent in the artery to open up the artery so the heart can get more blood flow.
That is correct. And if you happen to be in a rural area where there's no cath lab, still you need to be getting to the nearest emergency room where you can be treated for irregular rhythm or, as you mentioned earlier, for the clot-busting medication, which can open up the clot until patient can be transferred to a facility where there is a heart cath lab for final treatment.
Again, we always invite you to join the discussion. We will take your questions at 1-800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Our topic tonight, heart disease. Our guests include Dr. Neil Shabra with Cardiology Associates in Shreveport, Jill Lucero with the American Heart Association, and Jared Mitchell with the Willis-Knighton Cardiac Rehabilitation Program. You know, Jared, a lot of these patients who have had a heart attack, they may have had heart surgery. Heart surgery obviously involves opening the sternum, that's the bone that's in front of the heart, and it can be a long hospitalization. When a patient has recently had a bypass surgery and they want to start to mobilize again, what's your general approach to that?
Well, if they have bypass surgery, you need to have restrictions for upper body movement. We can do some movement and do some activity with the lower extremities, such as just simple walking or bicycling. But there should be a period of, roughly about 4 to 6 weeks where no movements with that upper body, let that sternum heal. And then after about that 4 to 6 week mark, then more activities can kind of take place. Patients can start getting back on their normal routine under the guidance of their doctors and us in cardiac rehab as well.
Dr. Shabra, talking about open heart surgery and cardiac bypass surgery, and we've already talked about stents and balloon angioplasty somewhat, what do you see as the role of open heart surgery and cardiac bypass surgery using today's technology to avoid open heart operations?
Open heart surgery is absolutely a marvelous procedure because not everybody is a candidate for stenting. And there are certain areas and certain blockages, and especially among diabetics, no procedures beat open heart surgery. So that's a integral part of heart treatment, bypass surgery at this point, especially if you're using arterial conduits in diabetics.
Thank you, Dr. Shabra. Dr. Shabra, we've talked about heart attack symptoms, the shortness of breath, sweating, chest pain. Many patients have that symptom and they may not be having a heart attack at all. I think some patients may suffer from a condition known as panic attacks or also anxiety. How does one differentiate between an anxiety problem or a panic attack and a heart attack?
I'm not sure you always can distinguish that. And anytime somebody has symptoms, our recommendation is that they should seek advice from their doctor on that. And there are ways to patient to get evaluated by getting examination, EKG, perhaps treadmill testing, and then depending on the results of that, one makes a decision whether it's anxiety if your cardiac workup is negative and addressing the risk factors in addition.
So I think you touched upon a number of things that have to do with surveillance for coronary artery disease. You mentioned treadmill testing, you mentioned an EKG. What is the role of surveillance and monitoring for cardiac disease, in particular atherosclerosis or coronary artery disease?
I think we have come to realize, based on the genesis of atherosclerosis happens in teenage years. And this was proven in the Korean Wars when they did autopsies on soldiers who were 18 and 20 years old, and they saw plaques in those. And also, we have seen such a huge increase in obesity in children, although there was a very heartening news yesterday in New York Times, where there's 43% reduction in childhood obesity between the ages of 2 and 5 between 2004 and 12. So the genesis starts there. People should, if you have risk factors such as diabetes, smoking, get your lipids checked, get your blood pressure checked, and get back with their doctor.
Yeah, we're going to get back to risk factors and surveillance here in just a moment. We have another caller. We have Peggy from Shreveport. Peggy, what's your question?
Hello. I'd like to know about post-op atrial fib. What causes it, and is there anything that can be done to prevent it?
Thank you very much, Peggy, for your question. You're Dr. Welcome. Shabra, what do you see as post-operative atrial fibrillation in terms of prevention?
Post-op atrial fibrillation is a fairly common condition that occurs in about 45 to 50% of our patients. It's primarily an inflammatory response to surgery. A lot of times, following surgery, patients will be placed on a drug to prevent this from happening, and then those drugs, antiarrhythmic drugs, can be tapered off. I'm not sure if there's anything that's 100% to prevent post-op atrial fibrillation. Generally, it's short-lived and resolves within 4 to 6 weeks at most.
Okay, thank you very much. You know, Dr. Schauber, you mentioned the decrease in childhood obesity that we've seen. We know that smoking is a large risk factor for heart disease. Jill, I know you come across a lot of young people in your line of work, and Dr. Schauber mentions that, you know, teenage smoking doesn't seem to be on the decline as much as it has been with adults. What is American Heart doing in terms of reducing the incidence of teenage smoking and educating our youngest members of society that smoking and perhaps, you know, overeating is not a good thing, obviously, for the heart, but, you know, it increases the incidence of diabetes, and we know the long-term cancer risk is certainly there with cigarette smoking.
The American Heart Association right now is, we have education programs for the schools, primarily middle school and high school, to help decrease and educate those students. Also parents on the trying to reduce the amount of cigarette smoking that the youth are doing today, and also educating them on the obesity side as far as some of the things that they can do to prevent the childhood obesity that we're seeing today. The education programs that are offered in the schools are available to all schools, and also, again, websites are available through the American Heart Association.
Does the American Heart Association work hand-in-hand, let's say, with curriculum development at the parish level in terms of health education, for example?
We have an advocacy group that does work with some parishes. I work with the Caddo Parish system here. Not much as far as curriculum development, but we do have a really great program in place that's working with the system. It's through the Clinton Foundation, and it's called Healthier Generations. And that system has been adopted by almost all of Caddo Parish schools. And that was founded by the American Heart Association through the Clinton Foundation. And that is structured on a strict curriculum for healthy eating, reduction in tobacco use, exercise, focusing on all those key points to help fight and continue to reduce the childhood obesity that we're seeing.
You know, there's a growing tendency for people who are trying to stop smoking to use inhaled nicotine vapor, or the quote-unquote e-cig. What is your take on that, and what is the American Heart Association recommending to folks who want to stop smoking and they're trying the e-cigarette?
I'm really not able to answer that question as far as what the take is on from the American Heart Association. But Dr. Shabra and Mr. Mitchell can probably answer that better from a medical standpoint as far as the nicotine aspects and the usage of those types of cigarettes. I would.
Dr. Chhabra, is nicotine harmful by itself without the tar and the other components in cigarette smoke?
My famous line to my patients is either you are a smoker or you're not a smoker. It's like being pregnant. Either you are or you're not. You don't smoke 5 cigarettes a day and say, I think tobacco in any form is harmful, whether it's inhaled or if it's chewed. I just want to go back to children. That's so critically important because those are the formative years. 18 to 20% of children in grade 9 to 12 smoke in America. And that's 1/5 of the patient, of the kids in high school smoke. Also, in 2011, 21% of the boys and 16% of the girls over the age of 18 were smokers. And that's a large number, and these are the numbers that we have not been able to impact. But I tell my patients who are smokers that smokers' kids grow out to be smokers. So it's incumbent upon them to stop smoking. So going back to the issue of nicotine, in my opinion, I don't have any studies to show you in that, in any inhaled form, is injurious to health.
Well, let's say one of your patients has come back, maybe have had a heart surgery, or maybe has had a heart attack. They've worked with Jared in rehabilitation, but they can't, you know, stop the nicotine habit. So maybe they're wearing a Nicoderm patch, or they're using Nicorette gum. What are your recommendations in terms of nicotine usage in those situations?
Basically, we sit down with the patient and the spouse, and it's just keep pounding, keep going back to them. Now, there are a few drugs that are available. We've had good luck with those. Not everybody can tolerate them without side effects, but people who want to quit, there are some help available. There's newer drugs that help, but you have to be willing to quit and wanting to quit. It's a painful thing. If you've smoked for 50 years or 40 years, very difficult to do that. But at the end of the day, you got to do it for you, for your family, and your children and grandchildren.
It's all about change. It's just like eating, your eating habits, your obesity. If you don't make the changes in your life, if a smoker is a teenager, then probably, you know, parent's going to be smoking, vice versa. Same thing with an overweight parent. If your parent is obese or overweight, then most likely the child is going to be, because those are the practices that they see in the household.
Jared, we've talked about your stopping smoking classes that are offered through the Willis-Knighton Cardiac Rehabilitation Program. Tell us a little bit more about those.
These are classes that we offer to the employees and public, that they can come with us and we can counsel them on ways to stop smoking. I think Dr. Chhabra is right. The first and foremost thing to stop smoking is your determination. You got to have the determination to do it. And then we provide a few little things to nudge you along the way that completes the process. One of the things that we do, I think is real neat, is that we have people chart every time they smoke a cigarette, and they describe what they needed. Was it a heavy need? What mood were they in? Were they happy? Were they sad? Were they depressed? You know, and it's almost kind of like a diet thing where if you want to lose weight and correct your diet, you need to chart what you are eating and how many calories you're eating. If you want to be successful, same thing with this, with the smoking. Make some chart to see exactly what's going on. Then we can get a game plan, and we have some success with that.
So using a chart, counseling obviously is very important. Jill, you mentioned a lifestyle change. So basically rearranging your life in a way that you're not going to be tempted to smoke or tempted to overeat.
Right.
The other thing, I'm sorry, Dr. Chhabra.
I was just going to add, and one of the things that I tell my patients is, sometimes they have to disassociate with people that they smoke with, because it's a group of people they're friends with. And I tell them, you got to throw away your ashtrays out of the house. You got to throw away your carton that sits there. And you're going to have to, if they're truly your friends, they will not smoke in front of you. And if there's one person, the spouse smokes and the other spouse had surgery, I encourage both of them to do that, because it's very difficult for one person to do when the other person in the household is still smoking.
Jared, do you see that from the rehabilitation standpoint? You know, many times, you know, personal trainers, folks on diets, folks trying to stop certain habits, do you find that it's helpful to have a partner?
Oh yeah, a supportive person is huge. The worst thing I've heard before is if someone's trying to stop smoking, and it's tough. It's a hard thing, and they get a little frustrated, and then their spouse or some supportive person says, "Well, if you're going to act like that, I wish you'd just go back to smoking." And I mean that's a horrible thing to happen. Yeah, support is very huge in regards to smoking. Or any other exercise routine or any other lifestyle change. And that's what I encourage. If you've got a family member or spouse that's trying to focus on something to improve their health, be very supportive in that endeavor.
Thank you very much. You know, Dr. Schauber, we're talking now about risk factors. We've talked about smoking. And obviously we've talked about, you know, lipid-lowering drugs. We've talked about the statins and lowering cholesterol. What are the recommendations now in terms of when should someone have their cholesterol checked, and at what levels of cholesterol do they need to start a medication or modify their diet? Do they do both at the same time? How do we approach the cholesterol and blood lipid issue?
If you have a family history and if you have other risk factors such as diabetes, hypertension, we recommend, obviously, in addition to the diet, if you're not at goal with the diet, and the goal with multiple risk factors would be a total cholesterol of 170, especially if you have diabetes, and your LDL below 100, or if you have diabetes, to get your LDL, which is your bad cholesterol, to 70 or below. At what age do you start checking? If you do have family history, you should have had your first cholesterol checked as a teenager, by a pediatrician, perhaps.
Thank you very much. We have another caller. We have Susan from Dangerfield. Susan, what's your question?
My question is this. My husband had three graft bypass in August. One of them failed after 6 months, and a couple of weeks ago he had a heart cath with two stents placed. If he were to have a cardiac event, he's not had a heart attack before, but if he were to have a cardiac event, can he have CPR performed on him with his chest wired?
Dr. Schauber?
I'm sorry to hear that one of the bypasses failed. That's generally not the case, but it does happen, especially if the bypass was put to a small artery, and you can get bypass failures. That being said, if something should happen, yes, the CPR can be done, chest compressions can be done. There is a risk of sternal fracture, which is higher than if you've not had a previous wiring, but that can be dealt with if the person survives.
Jill, are there any specific recommendations regarding the CPR performance in someone who has had a recent open heart operation? Anything specifically that American Heart says about that?
Just follow like Dr. Schauber says, follow the directives. Broken sternum can be fixed. Broken ribs can be fixed. Death cannot.
Well, Susan, we certainly wish you the best. And as Jill mentioned, anyone who is awake and breathing should learn CPR. Dr. Schauber, we're going to go ahead and talk about risk factors again. We talked a little bit about lipid lowering, and you talked about hypertension and family history. In terms of family history, what is really a family history? Because, you know, we hear about grandma or grandpa may have had a heart attack and there's, you know, 70s or 80s. But we also hear about these individuals who may have been running a marathon and they're 45, 46 years old and they have an acute MI. So there's a difference between having a family history of a heart problem as someone is older versus having an early family history, as you mentioned.
A positive family history, from our standpoint, is if your parents, sibling, or even grandparents had a cardiac event, such as a heart attack, when they were 50 or less, or 50 to 55 age, in that range. That is young, and that's positive family history. When your grandpa had a heart attack at 78, that is not a major risk. It's a risk factor, but it's not as important as it is if your immediate parent had somewhere in had an event in 50s.
And so someone who has a positive family history, let's say a myocardial infarction or a heart attack, at the age of less than 50, and they have no symptoms. They have no symptoms of chest pain, no exertional dyspnea, as we say, which is shortness of breath with heavy activity. Should they be screened for any sort of heart abnormalities, such as an exercise treadmill or have an EKG done?
They should have, first of all, a good examination with their primary care doctor, because history will elicit good questioning will elicit more symptoms that they may have passed it off for something else, such as heartburn, indigestion, taking Rolaids, etc. The next thing is examination, and then, of course, the EKG and stress test, etc., will elicit that. Now, given that the stress tests that we do are not 100%, but they're good screening tests in people who are at high risk.
So the EKG, would you consider that a screening tool as well?
EKG is a screening tool, but normal EKG does not rule out blockage in the arteries or heart disease. We know that for a fact.
Okay.
That's why stress testing becomes important to bring that out.
So a young individual, let's say someone in their late 30s or early 40s, you know, maybe developing a little bit of obesity, mild to moderate, moderately overweight, they may not have even seen a primary care physician in a number of years, and they have a positive family history. What should that individual do? Because the risk is elevated if they have a positive family history.
Go to your primary care doctor, ask for cholesterol check, ask for check to make sure you're not diabetic. If you're a smoker, don't smoke. Get your blood pressure checked. And if your blood pressure is elevated, treat that. And just be aware of any symptoms. And, of course, if you're obese, a good exercise program will go a long ways in helping all the way around.
And how many of these patients, typically males who have early onset coronary artery disease, present with a very severe heart attack as their first symptom of having coronary artery disease? Because this is fairly common. We hear about people who have had, there's this artery that goes to the heart called the left main artery that have, you know, significant stenosis or closing up of that artery at a very young age.
There's an artery that we call the widowmaker. That's the left anterior descending artery, which is a branch of the left main artery, which is actually commoner in younger people than left main obstruction. And statistics tell us that people who die of sudden deaths, 47% of the sudden deaths happen cardiac related, are outside the hospital and related to the high-grade stenosis and proximal LAD.
And so how do we get to these people who have this high-grade stenosis of the proximal LAD who have never had symptoms before? It's basically going to be, you know, a general approach.
Unfortunately, there's not a way to do that, because a lot of these people who have sudden heart attack, it happens because of plaque rupture. Most of the time in young people, it's not because they had a 95% blockage that became 100% in the absence of low blood pressure, very low blood pressure. But these people may have a plaque that's 40, 50% blocking the artery. And under certain conditions, the plaque gets inflamed, it gets swollen, and then it finally ruptures. When it ruptures, the cheesy cholesterol material weeps out into the artery, and that attracts what we call platelets as a component of blood, and that's what makes the blood clot. So a lot of the research now is geared towards recognizing what we call vulnerable plaque, that we think these are the plaques. Somebody may have five plaques. Which one's going to rupture? They're all 40%, 30%. We don't know that. That's where a lot of the research is directed. So short answer to your question is that, what do you do about these people? I'm not sure we have the answer yet, other than dealing with perhaps the risk factors.
The risk factors, you know, stopping smoking, maintaining an ideal body weight.
Make sure you're not as diabetic, hypertension treated, and hyperlipidemia treated.
And so we talk about diabetes and hypertension. What is hypertension? What do we consider a high blood pressure?
The definition keeps changing. The Hypertension Society, arm of the American Heart Association, 3 years ago had asked that the goal be 120 on over 80 in everyone. And in real life, it's extremely difficult for us to get our patients to do that. But they have slackened that up now. They've backed off because sometimes the side effects of the medicine trying to reach that goal were worse than the side effects of 130 or 85, especially when people got into 70s and 80s. So still our goal is to have a systolic 130 and under and diastolic 80 and under.
So 130 over 80 is what's considered the upper limit of normal for blood pressure.
Correct.
And Jill, are you aware of how the American Heart came to the conclusion that 120 over 80 was a little bit too low to aim for, and they moved back to 130 over 80?
I'm sorry, I don't. I don't know that.
And we always sort of talked about 140 over 90. And so if a patient goes to their primary care doctor, and let's say they are 130 over 80, what's going to be the first approach to getting their blood pressure down?
Most of the time, first thing, what we do in our practice is to make sure that's just not high blood pressure for the first visit that patient is seeing a new doctor and there's an element of anxiety. So what we do is we encourage the patient to get a blood pressure machine, own one, and monitor random blood pressures at home for a month and just mail it to us. And then we look at it, what's happening in real life. And indeed, if it pans out that the blood pressure is high and above those criteria, then we would treat that. So this is just to make sure that patients didn't have a true, quote, white coat syndrome where they go to doctor's office and the blood pressure goes up.
And, you know, years ago, dietary sodium was a significant topic of discussion around the topic of hypertension. What do you tell your patients now regarding dietary sodium or salt?
Still is. We tell them to use common sense diet in that the way easy way to do that is to avoid added sprinkled salt on anything, and I tell them to move the salt shaker away from the table, start reading the labels. And my favorite story to tell is some of my little old ladies' patients who would come back into recurrent congestive heart failure, and we couldn't figure out they would get better very quickly when they came to the hospital. Well, turned out they were drinking pickle juice, which is nothing but brine and high salt, and they would end up in the hospital. Finally, once we figured out, and I made it a habit now, to ask everybody, are you drinking pickle juice? So anybody out there who has high blood pressure drinking pickle juice, please lay that down.
Well, those of us, Dr. Chhabra, who like pickle juice, is it going to give us hypertension?
I don't think it's going to give you hypertension, but people who have congestive heart failure, it can tip you over.
Yeah, but seriously, is a salt habit, so to speak? There are those people who like to have extra salt on their foods, or a number of the hot sauces in Louisiana, a number of the foods that we like to eat in Louisiana can be quite salty or spicy. Is there a risk of developing hypertension from a diet that is high in salt or sodium?
If you're not genetically predisposed, I don't believe, unless you really consume huge amount of salt, but most of us who might consume 4 to 6 grams of sodium, it will not cause hypertension per se. But if you talk to a nephrologist, they want us all to be on 2 gram sodium diet.
Well, we don't have any nephrologists on our panel, but perhaps on our next discussion of heart disease, we should bring one on. Jared, when you see a patient who has heart failure, who's trying to undergo some rehabilitation, these are patients who have very, very poor exercise tolerance. What's the best way to get a patient with heart failure, let's say who's had a recent coronary intervention, mobilized again?
Well, I mean, a lot of people have aspect of exercise being something that, you know, it's real intense, something that is just that they can't do. But anybody, you know, people under these circumstances with a congestive heart failure, boy, they can benefit from low-level exercise. And we just take it small amount by small amount. They can rest when they need to. But over time, your body will respond to that exercise, and it can help a lot. I've had a lot of patients that have had a poor ejection fraction of around, you know, even less than 20%, and that's just very on the low end. But through, again, proper medication, sticking to that, and with the exercise program, boy, we saw that ejection fraction start creeping up. And so that's what you like to see. Exercise, just low level, walking, biking, stepping type exercise can really help out a lot.
So, Dr. Chhabra, does that imply that the heart is like any other kind of muscle? When it's worked, it's going to grow and get stronger?
Absolutely. We see that in athletes' heart. Young athletes, their hearts are actually larger and their stroke volume is much higher to cope up with the level of activity. So the heart muscle can get thicker, it can get larger and have more stroke volume.
Thank you very much. You know, Jill, we talked about the youth and we've also talked about family history. So what do we tell youngsters, children who, let's say, have a first-degree relative who has had a heart attack, you know, at an age less than 50? What is the approach to the quite young from that regard? I know we educate them about, you know, their personal history, but a lot of times they may not understand what their family history is and what the implications of that are.
When I work with the PE teachers and the coordinators through the events that I work with at the schools, Jump Rope for Heart, Hoops for Heart, and Red Out at the schools, one of the first things we do is we ask the kids, who knows somebody who's had a heart attack, stroke, high blood pressure? Most of these kids know what cholesterol is. They know that word. So it's relevant to them. And majority of the hands go up that they know. We ask how many have a brother or sister who's had some sort of heart problem, and they will raise their hand. And most of the time we'll ask how many did not raise their hand. And very seldom do we have anybody that did not raise their hand in the room, even down to kindergarten. So we talk to them about the importance of exercise, and the habits that they have now are what's going to affect them when they're older, because heart disease does not affect it's not just an old people's disease. It doesn't affect old people. It affects anybody from being born to 100. And so we really work with the kids on letting them know about the eating right, obesity, that video games does not count as exercise. They have to get out and move. And exercise can be fun. Teaching kids that exercise can be fun, that it's not a burden, and getting their parents involved, asking their mom and dads or grandparents, whoever they live with, go on a walk with me, come out and throw the ball. Anything that's going to get them moving, because like Dr. Schauber said, athletes' hearts get stronger, and it's anything that you do, whether it be a brisk walk, whether it be a slow walk with your grandparents or parents in the night, anything that you do is going to get those kids out and moving and getting their heart going. And the more their heart beats, the stronger it's going to be. So teaching them young about what they do now is going to affect them when they get older.
So creating good habits at an early age, good eating habits, good exercise habits, and what to stay away from, like, you know, high sugary drinks, I think, is an important thing. You know, high fast food, not smoking, all of the things that we need to stay away from, as well as what we need to do in the positive end.
Exactly. The things that cause, you know, some of the main factors that cause obesity in children or even in adults are the portions now are larger. You know, it's no longer just the portion size, so they're teaching in the schools now your healthy plate. And then the kids can see the portion, and they're, you know, they'll make comments like, oh, I eat twice as much. And so they're realizing now visually, children are visual, and they visualize that. So portions are growing. We're eating out more. It's easier for a lot of times just to drive through someplace and get it and pick it up than going home. And we're moving less. So
We have a question from a caller. Dr. Schauber, the caller wants to know, is there a connection between alcohol and hypertension?
There is a direct connection, and large amount of alcohol consumed will lead to hypertension, yes.
Is there any positive benefit? Is that still recommended? I think a small amount of alcohol daily, is that preventive in terms of heart disease?
In terms of heart disease, alcohol in moderation does seem to help. The theory went back to resveratrol, which was part of the grape, especially colored grapes, and hence the red wine correlation came in, the French paradox, where the French consumed a lot of high-fat diet, but they drank a lot of red wine. But they also have a lot of cirrhosis. So in small amount in moderation, women 5 ounces, men 8 ounces. In terms of drinking wine a day, it has been shown to be beneficial.
So in terms of someone who has actually been diagnosed with hypertension, you say that alcohol can cause hypertension, and they want to consider alcohol for cardiac prevention. Is that recommended or not?
I don't recommend anybody to start drinking if they're not doing that already, but if they're doing it, they can continue in moderation.
As long as their blood pressure is adequately controlled?
That's correct.
Okay. You know, one thing that's been very, very popular with the advent of advances in technology in heart disease are ventricular assist devices and heart transplantation and care of the terminally ill cardiac patient. Dr. Schauber, what do you see technologically in this area as the current state of affairs?
There are what we call LVAD, left ventricular assist devices, which have become implantable within the chest, and they're attached to a small battery pack where the patient can be ambulatory. And there has been a lot of good success, and that's what our ex-Vice President Cheney had before he got his heart transplant. And I think more of us need to be aware that hearts are not a commodity that's sitting on the shelf. And if you've never looked at your driver's license where you're a donor, one should consider doing that because they are absolute lifesavers, especially the young hearts. And nobody wants to see or think about a young person going, but accidents happen, and we all need to be aware that organ donation is a very important thing. Now, there are a couple other new things that are on the horizon, not necessarily with left ventricular assist device, but we're excited about the new wireless pacemakers that are on the horizon and should be here. They're about the size of a capsule, and they are attached inside the heart, and there's no outside wiring that goes to that, and they should be around before too long.
So a wireless pacemaker, how would that be placed in the heart?
You go in from the groin area through a vein and place it into the right ventricle.
So it's placed into the right side of the heart. That's
correct.
Where a pacemaker normally is placed. And these are normally electrical systems that go through the veins anyway. It goes into the heart with a wire, but it's attached to a battery that goes somewhere else.
Correct. And the battery pack, you know, and the computer part of that would be under the chest in the past. Now it's all encapsulated, miniaturized. The battery pack and the stimulator is all one single size of a capsule that goes into the RV apex.
Well, that's quite interesting. You know, there are automated defibrillators as well now that patients who have these malignant heart rhythms, their hearts can beat too fast and they can die, actually. And these can detect the patient's heart going into that rhythm and can be implanted. Is there anything on the horizon in terms of the automated defibrillators that patients
get? It's a matter of time that will come too. It's just that those require more energy and more battery life. And as the batteries get miniaturized, we already have the pacemakers. Defibrillators cannot be far away.
You know, I was seeing in the news just very recently, they performed the first beating heart transplant. Can you tell us what that was?
Not aware of that.
So I believe it was a heart transplant in which the heart wasn't cooled between the donor and the recipient. So the heart was taken basically at body temperature from the donor to the recipient. So I think the technology just continues to advance with regards to the terminal disease of the heart patient, as well as knowing more and more about prevention. Jared, when we talk about cardiac rehabilitation, you know, there are a lot of these patients, you know, were not in good condition before they had their heart attack, and they may be attempting to do exercise on their own if they're not discharged to cardiac rehabilitation. If they're on their own at home, what do you recommend in terms of getting started if they haven't been through a cardiac rehabilitation program before?
Well, the first thing, again, we referenced it earlier, I think there, if you do have bypass, you need to have appropriate sternal precautions. And then after a period of that 4 to 6 weeks, then you can gradually increase your activity. You need to take things step by step. Same thing with the exercise routine. Do what you can tolerate. If you can only do 5 minutes of walking, do 5 minutes. Next time, try six. And just take it step by step and listen to your body. Listen to your body is one of the main things that you can do, and just gradually build your step. But I get excited when I see patients progress, and I think a lot of heart patients, when they go through a heart event, boy, they are motivated to make some changes. And they end up being a lot of times more healthy because they lose weight, their blood pressure's better, maybe they've stopped smoking, their lung function's better. And a lot of times heart patients, they can end up living longer than some other people that have not been diagnosed with heart disease. So that's exciting to see sometime when people embrace that.
So, you know, starting the appropriate diet, starting the appropriate exercise program, stopping smoking, that's a lot to do at one time. And we mentioned, you know, doing it with a partner is a very important thing to consider, as well as doing it maybe with a family member, encouraging a family member to stop smoking. You know, we also talked about diabetes. Dr. Schauber, what do you see on the horizon in terms of the better control of diabetes, because we've had difficulty maintaining good diabetic control in the past?
The most exciting thing I heard was actually yesterday, where there's going to be change in labeling. You might have heard that. This just was in the news. That will give us better control on portions and bigger, boldly labeled number of calories and the amount of sugar in each of the prepackaged contents that you get for food. So that's number one. So it goes back to the awareness issue. And I think with the ongoing education, and I commend the First Lady for taking the lead with the children in that, with exercise and eating green and having the green vegetable patches that kids are doing in schools. And I think all of that is just the beginning of that, and we're already seeing some benefit with reduction in obesity among children. And I think that will show up as lower risk of diabetes, lower heart disease 15, 20 years down the line.
In terms of diabetes screening, what are our recommendations now for individuals who may be at risk for adult onset or type 2 diabetes?
I'm really not a diabetologist, so to say, but I will tell you the basic stuff I think most of us physicians do, that if they have obviously obtained a good history, if they have history of drinking too much water, going to the bathroom, with what we call polyuria and polydipsia, and if they're losing weight, that would be indication for diabetes development. But a simple blood test as fasting sugar, or a blood test called hemoglobin A1C, which gives us an average of 3 months level, is a good indicator. And we recommend that your A1C level should be around 6 to 6.5.
So 6 to 6.5% of the blood being the glycosylated hemoglobin, or the hemoglobin,
correct,
that has sugar attached to it. And the primary care physician, family practice doctor, internal medicine doctor would be able to perform that test.
Correct.
Well, that's very, very interesting. I think, you know, this has been a very interesting discussion, and I wanted to thank Dr. Anil Schauber with Cardiology Associates in Shreveport, Jared Mitchell with the Willis-Knighton Rehabilitation Program, and Jill Lucero with the American Heart Association. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance for tonight's show was provided by Kermit Poling, Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Jeff Bryant. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you for joining us this evening.